Now, world leaders are joining together at the COP27 Climate Change Conference in Egypt to talk about greenhouse gas concentrations and damage being done around the world. COP27 is short for the 27th year of the Conference of the Parties, or the 197 nations that agreed to a United Nations Framework Convention back in 1992. The United States is at the conference again this year. In a speech, President Biden talked about climate issues, including U.S.-China relations, alternative energy funding, drought, and wildfires. You could join in at 800-642-1234. What do you want to see happen when it comes to global cooperation, if any, on climate change issues? What do you want to see the U.S., the Biden administration, commit to? Do you have questions about the significance of this conference? What is going on? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Gregory Nemeth is a professor at the University of Wisconsin-Madison's La Follette School of Public Affairs. He specializes in energy systems analysis, policy analysis, and international environmental policy. Greg, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks, Rob. Good to be here.
I want to first talk about the significance of this event. A lot of world leaders showing up, at least, to make a speech here and there. A lot of countries involved. How important a forum is this when it comes to international cooperation on climate change?
Well, it's become the forum, as you said, since 1992, when 195 or so countries agreed to limit dangerous climate warming. We've had these annual conferences, and sometimes they're consequential, like 1997, the Kyoto Protocol, and 2015 with the Paris Agreement. And in the in-between years, there's kind of implementation, working out details, and starting new issues. And that's what we're seeing this time at COP27 in Egypt.
And setting the stage here, you mentioned past commitments made by countries around the world, especially leading industrial countries. How are we doing on those? How is the world doing when it comes to meeting emission standards that would slow the growth of climate change?
Yeah, well, the way I put it is the climate problem is getting worse, but the solutions are getting better. And so the problem is getting worse and that our emissions continue to grow and the temperatures continue to rise and we're seeing impacts everywhere. But on the other hand, the solutions that we have available, clean energy, ways of reducing emissions, ways of reducing energy, are becoming more affordable and performing better and becoming more efficient. So we've got good news and bad news on that. In terms of emissions themselves, which is kind of the focus of the COP. So the Paris Agreement in 2015, we had this agreement that the world would make efforts to keep warming well below 2 degrees and make efforts to keep it to below 1.5 degrees. And we're now at 1.2 degrees. And this is degrees Celsius, so about double that for Fahrenheit, above the pre-industrial average. So from 200 years ago when we weren't burning fossil fuels. So we're already pretty far along. And so there really isn't a lot of space to stay under 1.5 and even not much to stay under 2 degrees. So there really is urgency to go from really slowing down the rise in emissions, which is what we've been doing, to starting to reduce them, you know, immediately, like in the next couple of years to start having declines in emissions. And, you know, there's a lot of ways that we could see that actually happening, but it's imperative that we do.
And before we get to some of those strategies, this has come up over the course of the climate change conversation over the years. People might hear 1.5 degrees, 2 degrees, and think, well, that's not that much warmer. But on a global scale, how much impact could, say, a 2 degree Celsius temperature increase have?
Yeah, it sounds tiny because you go out into a hallway from a warm meeting room and it's 10 degrees cooler Fahrenheit. So yeah, it's tiny, but globally average, it makes a difference. I guess to put two ways I'd put it in perspective, we're talking about warming by 2 degrees. If we do cooling by, say, 4 or 5 degrees, which is what we had 20,000 years ago, there was a mile of ice on top of Madison. So just a few degrees makes a really big difference. And we're going in the other direction in terms of warming. The other thing people wonder is, well, you know, does 1.5 degrees really matter versus 2 degrees? And, you know, it does matter on an array of indicators, but probably the best way to put it is there are about 1 billion people whose lives will be significantly adversely affected at 1.5 degrees that at 2 degrees would be okay. Then there's other people that are going to be affected even at 2 degrees. So it really does make a difference, as people say, every degree matters, even though it's kind of unfortunate that we're using the same units that we have in our everyday life when the range is much bigger. But for the whole planet, it makes a big difference.
As I mentioned, President Biden stopped at the conference. Here's a listen to his speech talking about the U.S. commitment to reducing emissions.
Today, finally, thanks to the actions we've taken, I can stand here as President of the United States of America and say with confidence, the United States of America will meet our emissions targets by 2030.
By 2030, that ended. Is that going to happen? What would it take to get there, Gregory?
What it would take would be, you know, we have a lot of progress on technology and renewables are getting cheaper. Electric vehicles are becoming really high performing. But what we were missing was some kind of federal policy that would kind of set expectations that we are actually going to reduce emissions and then provide avenues for people to adopt these clean technologies that haven't already done that. And almost by a miracle, we did that in August. We have the first time the federal government, that Congress has passed a substantial climate policy, and that's the Inflation Reduction Act. So, you know, when Biden goes to COP, it's completely different. When he says those things now, it comes with credibility because those tax credits in the Inflation Reduction Act, one, it's the tax code, so it's really hard to change. This is not like executive orders that Obama signed and then Trump reversed. And two, this is legislation that is in place for the next 10 years. And so it really is aligning expectations that renewables will probably be about twice as much as we would have had without that. And that our emissions are probably going to reduce about 42% by 2030 instead of 27%. So it really does bend the curve. So yeah, Biden says that with credibility, whereas if we had not passed the Inflation Reduction Act, which is what it looked like in mid-August that we would not pass it, you know, he would not be able to make that kind of proclamation. So things are moving in the direction, in the right direction in a lot of areas, and U.S. federal policy for the first time is one of those things that's moving in the right direction.
Talking to Gregory Nemeth from UW-Madison's La Follette School, looking at the big climate change conference, almost 200 countries involved right now in Egypt. You could join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions about efforts to rein in climate change, the U.S. role in it, what you'd like to see from the U.S., from countries around the world. 800-642-1234 for your comments or questions. That's 800-642-1234. Greg, you mentioned emissions are one big theme. Another theme in this conference is who is causing climate change and who is suffering the consequences, often not the same countries. What's going on when it comes to the damage of climate change and who's liable for it?
Yeah, that's an important issue, and it's been raised to a really high profile issue this time at the COP. The basic issue is that when you put greenhouse gases into the atmosphere, they stay there a long time, like 100 years. It's really different from things like air pollution and particulates that rain out in matters of weeks. And so that means that all the development and emissions that have happened over the last 100 years, say, are still in the atmosphere now and stay in the atmosphere and continue to cause damages. And those damages are not connected at all to where the emissions came from. It's just a global soup of CO2 that's up there. And it turns out that if you live in a country that's primarily source of GDP is agriculture, and you're in a country where incomes are low, and you're in a country that, for whatever reason, is sensitive to things like weather events like monsoon or drought, or you know, low precipitation, those make you very vulnerable. And so at this COP, there's for the first time on the agenda this term called loss and damage, that there should be some compensation from those who have created the problem, developed countries, to those who are suffering the biggest effects, which are countries in the global south that have lower incomes and are more sensitive to what's happening with the climate. And so we'll see what comes out of that. That's probably one of the biggest open issues in the next 3 days for the rest of the conference, to see what text, what can be agreed on in terms of commitments of financial flows from the global north to the global south.
I understand there's some reluctance from countries, including the U.S., to participate in something like that, or at least in how it's framed, because of the question of are we admitting liability in a legal sense if we pay this kind of compensation from a developed country to a country suffering the impacts of climate change? Is that an admission that under international law could say they can sue us under international law?
Yeah, I guess that's the concern. I mean, because for a lot of reasons, for any kind of, I don't know, just a pretty intuitive moral reason, we've created all this damage that's real and people are suffering from it, and that's real. And that finding a ways to, you know, alleviate their suffering with some financial flows that, you know, these are small amounts that we're talking about. large amounts for these countries, but in terms of, you know, GDP of rich countries, these are tiny amounts. But yeah, I guess that is one of the negotiating positions to say, well, if we admit that there is damage that we've caused, that we open ourselves to, you know, I don't know, some kind of bigger movement on that. But, you know, I think there's just some inevitability to this now because we've taken so long to do something about it. So it's really been 34 years when we had the first congressional hearings on climate change in 1988. And here we are today, just starting to say that we might get emissions to fall in the next couple of years. And so we've burnt out a lot of time, like literally burnt a lot of fossil fuels, but we've used up a lot of time. And that's, you know, why we now have damages that we're going to have to pay for. And we're going to have to pay for it in our own country and in our own state, some of it. And then, so, you know, I think it suits that we would end up paying for some of the damage we've caused to other states as well.
Talking to Gregory Nemeth, professor at the UW-Madison La Follette School of Public Affairs, looking at this year's UN Climate Change Conference going on right now in Egypt. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What climate issues matter the most to you? Is climate on your mind? Was it during the election? What do you want to see from the U.S. when it comes to leadership on the issue, from other countries around the world? What questions do you have about what's at stake here? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with Gregory Nemeth, professor at the UW-Madison La Follette School of Public Affairs, with us today to talk about the UN Climate Change Conference happening now in Egypt. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you worried about the implications of climate change? What do you want to see from the federal government, from corporations, from the global community when it comes to climate change? What questions do you have? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. David joins us now in Jackson County. David, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I've been an environmental engineer my whole career mostly in air quality, and I've worked on a lot of the problems we've had in the state, acid rain, tires, leaking tanks. I want to know if there's something we can push for in our state to help improve our biodiversity and thus create more more oxygen, less CO2, because I do see a few areas that we could look at. I just don't know the numbers, and I haven't seen any cost-benefit impacts.
Gotcha. But, David, thanks for the call. Greg, things we could do here in Wisconsin. David mentioned biodiversity, that or other options that the state could take to contribute.
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty clear to me that it's really just about transitioning away from fossil fuels to some other form of energy that's cheap, that's clean, and that's reliable. That's, I think, what everybody wants. And we now have tools that are available because of tremendous innovation that's happened. We've had solars come down in cost by 90%. Batteries for electric vehicles have come down in cost by 90%. So, you know, the battery pack in a Nissan Leaf that 10 years ago was $40,000. Just for the batteries is now $4,000. And so electric vehicles are now getting priced just like internal combustion engine cars. And so we've got these tools now that are affordable, and we've got congressional leadership with the Inflation Reduction Act that's giving Wisconsin and other consumers tax credits for purchasing electric vehicles, for installing solar panels and installing heat pumps, and moving away from fossil fuels in their homes and in transportation. And, you know, I think it's up to us as a state then to make the most of that. And some of that resides in what the governor's office can do in the state legislature. A lot of it, I think, goes in the Public Service Commission and how they make determinations about expanding electric vehicle charging infrastructure and switching to renewables. But these tools are available, and they actually work, and they're proven, and it's up to us to take full advantage of that and not go too slow on it. I think that's my biggest concern. I think the electrification of transportation, people that drive electric vehicles realize it's a transformative experience. It's more fun. There's, you know, things you can do. It's different. But we need to make these changes pretty quickly. If we end up being too cautious and too slow on it, we're likely to you know, suffer some of the environmental damages that that David raised in his concern about the call. So I think what we can do is take advantage of what Congress now has given us and implement those well in our state.
Thanks for the call, David, at 800-642-1234. Another issue, I think, at the conference, Greg, is with countries with less developed economies that want to develop them. They look at England and then the U.S. and then Europe and now China and India. They did a lot of that with coal, and then they did a lot of that with oil. Is there, what kind of options are there to help countries in that situation skip the fossil fuel phase and do something else that's not going to have that climate change impact?
Yeah, you know, I think that's exactly what we're kind of wanting them to do. And, you know, that's a lot of what with the clean development mechanism and other efforts that have been implemented over the last 20 years of these agreements have tried to do. You know, I think it was just never completely convincing because it always seemed kind of expensive, or if developed countries were funding these, they were kind of funding them there so they didn't have to change their own economies. That's kind of the experience of the 90s and the early 2000s. But now when you look at renewables potentially being deployed in rapidly growing economies, you know, China is very far along, but India now is making important decisions about whether they develop with coal or solar, and they kind of go back and forth from year to year on which one they prioritize. They're really on the fence about it. And then other big economies that are growing that are going to have large shares of population, like Indonesia, Nigeria, and Vietnam, really have the chance to skip the fossil fuel economy. And, you know, now we're at a stage where it's less expensive in kind of a full life cycle, building a grid with based on renewables and electrified transportation than it would be with fossil fuels. And I think that was a promise that I think a lot of developing countries kind of didn't really believe, because they said, well, as you suggest in your question, you know, all these rich countries developed with fossil fuels, why should we have to do it in a different way? But now it's gotten to the point where this different way is actually better, because it not only helps the global climate, but it helps local air pollution. And think about cities and some of these developing economies and the air pollution there. So there really are these health co-benefits in the near term and local that I think will drive a lot of the adoption. And it's really not about sacrifice and about paying more at this point. It's about just doing things differently. And that's the hurdle we need to make.
Let's go back to our callers. Virginia is with us now in Rock County. Virginia, hi.
Hi. You know, there's a major emphasis on fossil fuels to the exclusion of everything else. And one of the worst causes of climate change is animal production. An estimated 85% of all U.S. agriculture land is used in the production of animal fuels. And we have deforestation, we have habitat destruction. All over the world, animal production is a problem. And at this conference, they had a chance to make an issue of that. And instead, have you looked at the menu? They're flying salmon in from halfway across the world.
Virginia, I gotcha. Greg, animal agriculture, how big a factor is that in climate change?
Yeah, it's a good point to raise. It's a big factor. You know, getting protein from animals is super inefficient, because you're basically using all this energy and land and feed to, you know, grow an animal that you use just a small part of. So yeah, if we wanted to really reduce emissions completely, we need to reduce emissions in agriculture, and there's ways to do that. But a lot of it has to do with what we were just talking about eating less meat and switching to different, less carbon intensive meat. So I think it's an important issue to raise. And it's one that I think a lot of people are uncomfortable raising, that we might have to make changes that are not just about the energy infrastructure, but about our daily life, how we get around, how we get to work, and even what we eat. That seems really intimate. And I think a lot of people are, you know, averse to other people telling them what to do about what they eat, and some governments are actually quite, you know, hesitant to do that or prohibit that from their citizens. But boy, there's a lot of changes that, like that, behavioral changes that could make a big difference. And, you know, if you just look at some of the lifestyles in really low energy intensive situations, they look pretty appealing. It's not about sacrifice. It's not people that are being poor, but it does involve changing some habits, changing behaviors, and in some cases, some investment. So I think, yeah, it's good to raise that too. It's about some of the behavioral changes as well.
Time for one more caller. Bruce is with us in Bayfield. Hi, Bruce.
Yeah, hi. I'm very happy to hear your speaker make mention of lifestyle, because while technology is certainly a part of the solution, looking at the fossil fuel industry, looking at agribusiness, those are all pieces of the puzzle. But perhaps most important is that we look at our consumption levels. We've got 8 billion people on the planet. We cannot continue to consume, especially those of us in affluent countries like the United States. We cannot be consuming 10 times what the average person in the world consumes.
Bruce, thanks for the call. Just a minute or so left. Greg, do you see a mindset change coming that Bruce is looking for there?
I do. Yeah, I see it on college campuses where I am. The amount of vegetarian options is really growing, and it's a peer thing. So students may have initiated it for whatever reason, and their roommates start doing it, and other people they eat with start doing it. So some of these lifestyles can spread. And again, you know, it's not all about sacrifice and doing without it. It's often just making a change that can be pretty appealing and have a lot of other benefits, often their health benefits, which are really important to a lot of people. So yeah, I think that's an important, really important part of this global issue that we're talking about, is some of the local and even personal changes that can make a difference.
Greg, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you. Great to be here.
I've been talking to Gregory Nemet, professor at the University of Wisconsin-Madison's La Follette School of Public Affairs. He was with us to talk about the two-week COP27 Climate Change Conference. It's going on now, last week of the conference, right now in Egypt. U.S. participation there. If you have a climate question, something you've been wondering about, let us know, and we might tackle it in a future segment. Email ideas@WPR.org.